All right, Hurley Burleyites, welcome back to the pod this week. I'm going to get right to it today because I'm so damned excited about our guest. We have Patrick Bishop here. Mr. Bishop is associate editor of the Daily Telegraph newspaper, the originator of the television series The Irish Empire, and is one of Britain's best-regarded military historians with a number of books including Bomber Boys and Wings. He's got a new book out, and interestingly enough, he chose the Battle of Dieppe as his subject matter. The book is called Operation Jubilee. Dieppe, 1942, The Folly and the Sacrifice. Amazing book, incredibly well-researched and thoroughly documented and utterly depressing to read. I had a particularly keen interest in reading it because coming from southern Saskatchewan, my mom didn't talk a lot about the war, but she had a very strong opinion about Dieppe and about the unfairness of Dieppe toward Canada. So I was quite interested to read the book, and my mom was right. Patrick, welcome to the Hurley Burley, just one day before Remembrance Day. It's really great to have you here. Thank you for making the effort to join us.
Well, it's great to be here, David. Thanks for asking me.
So, where are you?
I'm in London.
You're in London. How are you doing? There's still a pandemic there, isn't there?
Yeah, but it's kind of, you wouldn't actually know it. I was in Paris recently, and everyone there is very observant. They're all wearing masks. To go into a restaurant, cafe, anything, you have to show this pass sanitaire, you know, essentially your COVID passport. Whereas here, it's much more free and easy. I think young people in particular have come to the conclusion that they've either had the illness or friends of theirs have, nothing too terrible has resulted. And so they're pretty kind of free and easy about it. If you're my age, you're not quite so. Carefree, but
Do you have so you have vaccine hesitancy over there too, eh? You have people that don't want to get the jab, as you call it?
I think it's a combat. Well, I think you got hardline anti-vaxxers. Then you just have people who have just had enough of the rules, really, and are just kind of gradually eroding their observance of them. So I think it's more the latter than the former.
Right. But you're safe and you're good. You've been healthy through all this?
Yeah, I mean, my wife and I were saying the other day, we're about the only two people we know who haven't had it. So that sort of makes you extra, you know, part of you thinks, let's just get it over with. And another part thinks, okay, well, so far, so good. Let's keep it that way.
Right. Well, I just want you to know that I've done my sacrifice for the British Empire, and I took the AstraZeneca vaccines, even though it's clearly been demonstrated to be inferior. But nonetheless, I did my bit.
Good for you.
So I'd just like to get a little sense from you. You've written a lot of military histories now. What is it you like about them? How did you get into that? You started off as a journalist and then morphed into, and you're still a journalist, but you've morphed into writing these military histories. And I'm just interested in what moves you to do that.
Yeah, well, I didn't know much about military history when I first encountered war. So I was sent off to the Falklands War in 1982. And that gave me a taste for the military. And I went there like most of the contemporaries, journalistic contemporaries who were on board the Canberra with me, had a pretty dim idea of what the military did. And what we did know, we didn't particularly like, you know, the kind of prevailing political ambience of the time, particularly in the media. I was working for a kind of leftish newspaper, The Observer, was to be suspicious of the media. Of the military. What we knew about the army at the time was very much what they were up to in Northern Ireland, which was not a very happy episode for the army. They were kind of put there really as policemen. They were undertrained. The whole thing rapidly degenerated into a confrontation between the Catholics, the nationalists, who one was instinctively on the side of. So, you know, we took a pretty dim view, I suppose, really, of soldiers. And that changed quite rapidly on the way down. I think very condescendingly and erroneously, we got the idea that soldiers weren't terribly clever. They just did what they were told, et cetera, et cetera. And it was a very pleasant, rather humbling surprise to find out they were actually rather thoughtful. They actually put a great deal of study into what they were doing. And they were good guys on top of everything else. They looked after us. I mean, that's something that was became vital, because in the South Atlantic on the Falklands there was no infrastructure at all. I mean, there was no hotel to go back to. There was no hospitals or anything. So we were completely, really, at the mercy of their kindness, if you can put it that way. And so, you know, they were terrific with us. They got us into shape. They looked after us. They were very open with us. So I came back, I think, like everyone, a bit of a fan of the military. And that persuaded me to start reading up on it. And one thing led to another. I actually went on to cover many more wars after that. And always had a good relationship with the British military, and indeed the Canadian military, who I encountered in Afghanistan, and the American military.
My question was, how did you end up choosing Dieppe? I mean, I would have thought that Dieppe was a pretty big deal in Canada, but not much of a, but a pretty small event in the history of England. What brought your attention to Dieppe?
To be honest, it was actually my editor at Penguin who suggested the subject to me. He had a couple of ideas. And so I hadn't, to be, like you said, I hadn't actually given a huge amount of thought to Dieppe. I knew roughly what had happened. I knew that it was largely regarded as a disaster. I knew that it was largely a Canadian affair. But several things piqued my interest in it. One was the actual business of how a disaster happens. What is the anatomy of a catastrophe, if you like? How the decisions are made. How
you nailed that. That
critical point where the forward momentum impels you towards doom, if you like. I was also quite interested in the French side of it. I was living in Paris at the time, and I always have had a keen awareness of how the war impacted on ordinary French people. So I thought, here's a good chance to actually look at that in microcosm. So a bit of the book is dedicated to the experience seen from the kind of Dieppois eyes. So all those things combined to make me think this is a good subject. It has, of course, been done before very well indeed by Canadian historians. So I've trod fairly carefully and always was aware that my perspective was kind of slightly limited, more than slightly limited, by the fact that I'm a Brit. And so I tried my best to put myself in the Canadian shoes. And that was, again, part of the enjoyment of the research was looking at things from a Canadian perspective. I know Canada a bit. You know, I've visited several times. I've got very good Canadian friends who helped me a lot with this, actually, sort of just talking through the Canadian psyche, if you like, and, you know, learning a lot about where Dieppe sits in Canada's national memory.
Yeah, well, in southern Saskatchewan, pretty highly. Pretty strong memory there. So the book is, I want to get all these adjectives in there. The book is a remarkable tale of ambition, recklessness, vanity, bureaucracy, and incompetence. Is that mostly what war is like? Is this thing an exception, or is that normally how it goes down?
Yeah, that's a very good question and a good observation, because I think there is a tendency when you're looking back down the years to forget just how confused and contingent war is. People are making decisions that in peacetime they would take months, if not years, to actually arrive at a conclusion over. And in wartime, they're having to do it in days, weeks. So inevitably, there are going to be mistakes, blunders, etc. But I think even in that state of instant decision making and confusion, you can still be critical of certain processes and certain decisions. And I think it's fair to actually look at Dieppe with critical eyes, okay, taking into account this is wartime. But at the same time, the whole thing did unfold over several months. So there were plenty of occasions when what appears to be trouble ahead is there on the horizon, but people still kind of sail towards it. A friend of mine, Max Hastings, said when I was talking to him the other day about Dieppe, he said, you know, you've got to, I always say to civilians, you've got to remember that you can't judge a military disaster in the same way as you judge a civilian airline crash or something like that. You know, it's just not fair, and it's historically misleading, distorts the truth. And I completely agree with that. So I've tried to do that. But having said that, there still are guilty parties. There still are mistakes that, even taking into account the fog of war, should not have been made.
No. I mean, first of all, people made decisions for reasons that aren't valid reasons for making decisions, personal ambition, desire to climb up the ranks, etc. And then a number of people signed off on a plan that, as you demonstrate, anybody with any military experience should have looked at it and said, that's not going to work. And they, in fact, all did know it was not going to work, and they let it go ahead anyway.
Yeah, I think you've got to look at it from, look at the big picture, the big strategic picture. And I think that the pressure, the huge diplomatic and political pressure on the Brits to do something at that point, which was coming from two directions, coming from Moscow and coming from Washington, really made the plan and its chances of success less important than the fact that they were doing it. So it was actually action for its own sake, in order to persuade the Americans and the Russians that we were serious about a second front soon, that we were going to do something to relieve the pressure on the Eastern Front, to do something in answer to the very impassioned calls coming from Joseph Stalin. You've got to do something to help me here. You've got to do something that would divert German forces away from the Eastern Front. On the American side, it's, okay, we're in the war now, and now we want to get on with it. So they had to satisfy those two demands. And so Dieppe was as good as anything. And that really
drove it on.
They didn't have anything else on the table, right? Yeah, there were other options, but looking at them, one of the things that struck me was just how Dieppe, okay, balmy though it sounds to us now, there were other possibilities that were even more hazardous. There was one called Operation Imperator, which was to land a large armored force in the Pas-de-Calais, that is just on the other side of the English Channel, which would then drive to Paris, 180 miles or so, smash up the military headquarters there, turn around, drive all the way back, be picked up and taken back home again intact. I mean, it's a completely ridiculous idea, which mercifully an Air Force commander pointed out, well, if someone was doing that on this side of the channel, I'd be delighted, because what I would do is just, I wouldn't even bother shooting up the tanks. I'd shoot up the petrol tankers, which would inevitably have to be accompanying them to keep them refueled. The tanks would then grind to a halt, and then I could pick them off, or my boys could pick them off at their leisure. So that was a pretty idiotic idea, which was shot down, literally. And then there was another one, which the Americans were very keen on, Sledgehammer, which was an operation to seize the whole Cherbourg Peninsula, hold it indefinitely, being resupplied by sea, as a sort of redoubt that would force the Germans to switch resources away from the Eastern Front.
And Churchill really didn't want to do that.
Well, no, I mean, it was the Americans were keen on it, but it was obvious, again, as you say, from just anyone with a bit of military common sense could see that the resupply problems would be horrendous. The Air Force couldn't really guarantee anything other than sketchiest air cover during and after the operation. So it was just, you know, it was a non-starter. Even though it was a non-starter, it was on the table for months and months and months. They kept coming back to it. So Dieppe looks actually kind of fairly sensible by comparison.
I'm sure you've heard the expression game the system, but have you ever tried to do it? Game the system? In a situation where the stakes were so high, hundreds of thousands of people would lose quality of life, all because you wanted to personally profiteer to the tune of millions of dollars? No, I'm thinking you haven't done that. But it's happening right now in rural communities all across Canada, where a few billionaire-controlled regional cable companies are not using government spectrum subsidies to do what they're supposed to do, provide high-speed digital connectivity to the good people who live in those communities. Nope, their game is to use social policy as an investment tool. take the subsidies and just sit on them. Wait. Provide no service. Build no cell towers or other infrastructure to help rural communities connect. And eventually, resell the spectrum on the secondary market for millions of dollars in profit. I'm sad to say this is not a one-time loophole, hurly-burlyites. It's happening over and over again. Rinse and repeat. And the people who live in our rural communities are the ones getting rinsed. As a technology leader with a social purpose, this is not how our presenting sponsor, TELUS, does business. TELUS believes that if you say you're going to work with government and take their spectrum subsidies for rural Canada, then you have an obligation, a responsibility to provide that service to rural Canada. As I said before, the stakes are high. These places need high-speed connectivity to deliver proper health care and education so people can farm their land with the latest technology and do business beyond their borders. Otherwise, they leave. Rural, remote, and Indigenous communities wither and die. Here's a starting point. Right now, with infrastructure that's already in place, TELUS could boost service to over 250,000 households in Alberta and BC if spectrum that was being held for profit by others was simply unlocked. Go to telus.com/connectingcanada to learn more. So that's one of the big things about the book, I think, is that the explanation for Dieppe has always been training ground for D-Day, learn what we needed to learn to make D-Day successful, and that D-Day was as successful as it was, Normandy was as successful as it was because of the lessons learned at Dieppe. That's always been the explanation, and you reveal that to be a bullshit ex post facto rationalization for the exercise, which leaves the only persuasive argument for Dieppe, the one you just outlined, which is that Stalin's under tremendous pressure on the Eastern Front. The Americans are worried he's going to quit and sign up with the and sue for peace with the Germans. And Stalin wants to see some evidence that the West will shoot some Germans somewhere. And presumably, you don't get into this much, but you reference it. The carnage on the Eastern Front was so bad that to tell Stalin that you didn't want to do a military maneuver because you might lose 2,000 or 3,000 people probably wasn't very persuasive to him.
No, absolutely not. I mean, in our terms, what happened that day was horrendous. You know, 900 Canadians killed in a couple of hours. But on the Eastern Front, at the same time, the casualties, average daily casualties, were something in the region of 26,000 people being killed, wounded, or taken prisoner. So, you know, it's a, in Russian terms, it's a skirmish. But I think that the small scale of the event makes it still horrible. It's kind of understandable and imaginable in a way that what happens on the Eastern Front isn't to us. It's just too vast and too bloody for us to actually visualize it. But it was very easy to visualize what happened at Dieppe, particularly as you, as a South Saskatchewan boy, will know. You know, whole little kind of settlements, everyone would know someone who'd lost a son at Dieppe, or indeed, you know, several families. Absolutely. In the community would have lost sons at Dieppe. Because one woman lost Mrs. Elizabeth Murphy. I don't know what town she was in. She got telegrams telling her that three of her sons were in captivity and one was dead. You know, this is a kind of really very heavy emotional blow to land on small communities.
Yeah. So I didn't hear this when I was a kid. Your book has a clear villain. I'm not sure we agree on who it is, by the way. Because I think you think the villain of your story is Lord Mountbatten. But by the time I was done reading the book, I wanted to exhume that Creerar guy. I don't know how to say his name, the Canadian military leader. I wanted to exhume that guy just to beat the shit out of him. He's the villain of the story as far as I'm concerned. Why were these two Canadian military leaders that were stationed in England so desperate for their men to fight in war that they sought no conditions? There was no terms on which they wouldn't send these boys into battle. They're the villains, McNaughton and Creerar.
Yeah, I'm interested to hear you say that. I think I'm having, looking back over the book, I think maybe I was a bit soft on them, really. I think Mountbatten would have found it very hard to he certainly pushed for the raid on Dieppe to be remounted after it had been cancelled. The listeners have got to remember that the thing really went in two phases. The raid was all set up at the beginning of July, and everyone was set to go. They were all on the ships, all battened down, ready to sail, and just this terrible weather set in, and the thing was postponed and postponed and postponed, and then eventually cancelled. So at that stage, it was pretty clear that it was a dodgy enterprise. And the political pressures we were talking about earlier are beginning to lift, because there's an agreement now with the Americans that we're going to have a major landing in North Africa. Now, that may not be exactly what Stalin wanted, but it's certainly a lot better than just a hit-and-run raid. Yeah, so the situation's changed, the pressure's lifted, yet the raid's still there. So when this godsend opportunity, you might think, to cancel it full time arises, you'd imagine it would be grasped eagerly by all the participants, which is pretty much the case, except for Mountbatten. Mountbatten said, no, we can do it again. When it was pointed out to him, well, yeah, the Germans will surely get to hear about it, he replied with some reverse logic, saying, no, but think about this. They won't ever believe that we're going to be crazy enough to go back and attack the same place a second time. And amazingly, that argument went down okay with Churchill and the chiefs. But what you say is absolutely right. If it hadn't been for the Canadians agreeing with this, you know, ridiculous reverse logic, then the thing could have been consigned. It would never be a footnote in history now. But Crerar and McNaughton were both very keen to get their boys into action. Now, this is a crucial element in the book, because subsequently, when people were looking for excuses, they said the Canadian troops have been kicking their heels in Britain for 2 years now, and they were thirsting for action. Now, I'm sure you know soldiers, and I know soldiers, and you know no soldier is desperate to go to war simply for the sake of going to war. They might, in this case, I think, yeah, the Canadians were keen to fight, but for the purpose of getting home again in one piece. You know, they wanted to be sent into action in order to speed up the war and bring it to an end and get back to peace. But the idea that they were actually, you know, craving action is nonsense. But having said that, I think their commanders, for different reasons, political reasons, reasons of ambition, vanity, wanted to show the Brits, yeah, we're up for it, and we can do the job. And right from the beginning, McNaughton in particular has been volunteering his men, even though they've just arrived in England just around the time of Dunkirk. He's offering to send troops across the Channel to shore up what is clearly a doomed rearguard action in northern right. France. So he's got a lot of form on this one. He's always saying, yes, our boys are ready. And the Brits treat the Canadians with quite a high degree of condescension because of this attitude, I think, because of the kind of apparent inferiority complex that both Crerar and McNaughton suffered from. They are sort of pretty sure that anything they ask the Canadians to do, they will do. So, yeah, I mean, I don't retract my idea that basically the main villain was Mountbatten. The reasons I've said, if he hadn't proposed reviving the operation, there wouldn't be anything for the Canadians to agree to. But yeah, the Canadian High Command certainly share a big chunk of responsibility.
So I'm involved in politics here in Canada, and I pay a lot of attention to government. One of the things that stuck out to me like a sore thumb in your book was when you were talking about the military objectives of America, Franklin Roosevelt and his advisors frequently come up as being intimately involved in having a point of view about what would occur. Churchill is obviously briefed on everything that is going on in the war and signing off on everything. There is one brief reference in your book to something about the raid on Dieppe being sent to cabinet in Ottawa for approval. But there is no mention of the Canadian government, of Mackenzie King, of the Minister of Defense, of the Canadian cabinet, having any point of view about Dieppe before it happened or being involved in any way. That really struck me as very strange.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. I mean, the relationship between the Brits and the Americans and the Brits and the Canadians is very, very different. And in the case of the Americans, they are, although they are behind the Americans' backs, they're, again, dismissive, condescending. The view of the kind of senior American, British brass is these Americans don't know anything about war. They've only got a tiny little army. Okay, they've got the means of delivering victory in the end, but they can't tell us anything about how to run a war. You think there might be a bit more humility there, given that they'd actually lost every land battle they'd fought at this point. But no. But to their faces, the Americans' faces, they're obsequious, flattering, and the truth is, they know, despite their private opinions, they've got to take the Americans seriously. They've got to take them into account. Now, this is something that was actually not particularly welcome to them. But the fact is that once the Americans are in the war, their opinions count, and they increasingly carry weight. So by the end, the Americans are actually dictating what's going to happen. Now, the poor old Canadians are not anywhere near in that situation. They are contributing a considerable amount to the war effort. And you'd imagine that would give them some leverage, or indeed give Crerar and McNaughton some sort of sense of, we can start asserting ourselves here now a bit. I was very interested in the relationship between the First World War and the Second World War. Now, the First World War, Canadians very much trying to prove themselves. They're trying to impress their older brother, if you like. You know, we're up for this. We're actually pretty good. And there is no doubt that they were both up for it and pretty good. They proved that at Vimy Ridge. They proved it at Passchendaele. They proved that their commanders were at least as competent as their British counterparts. And after the war, you see this sort of feeling in Canada. Okay, we've been through all that. You know, we've made these enormous sacrifices of blood. So next time this happens, we're not going to just meekly go off to war and be under British control and just behave like these sort of, you know, colonial cousins who do what they're told. As a lot of that is out there, as you know, in the politics of interwar Canada, there are endless occasions in politics where they say, if there's another European war, we're not sending a single soldier. We'll defend our own shores, but we're not going to send any troops overseas again to be commanded by the British. But of course, when war comes, that is exactly what happens. The reasons for that, I don't know. You know much more about it than I do, why there was this change of mood. But the reality was that in 1942, you've got these, you know, considerable numbers of Canadian troops, and you have Canadian commanders, both Crerar and McNaughton, who served in the First World War, but whose attitudes remained that kind of deferential, country cousin sort of view of the relationship with the British hierarchy. So, sorry, this is a very long-winded answer, but you have to have this preamble. Now, Crerar and McNaughton both have considerable autonomy in Britain. So the Ottawa has basically said to him, you know, we'll leave it up to you to kind of go through all the plans and everything. If you agree with the plan, then we'll sort of take your word for it. We're not going to have a huge debate back here about what's going on, because we don't, you know, it was a reasonable attitude, because we're not competent to actually judge the merits of a plan. That's your job. And so when McNaughton signs off on the plan without having had a hand in the plan, there was no Canadian officer present in the formulation of the first plan. When it's remounted, then the Canadians actually take over military responsibility, but they do nothing to actually alter the substance of the original plan. And when it all goes horribly wrong, everyone's, you know, McNaughton and Crerar are heavily invested in the whole thing. So is the Canadian government, because, as you say, it hasn't actually involved itself in the process. So something that struck me and something I looked quite hard to find was whether there was any personal antipathy by Mackenzie King towards Churchill or towards the Brits, whether it was behind the scenes, there was any kind of exchange that suggested that the Canadians, whatever they were saying in public, actually were pretty sore about this and wanted things to change on the ground. I couldn't find anything substantial. I think the problem was that because the Canadian government backed the narrative that was presented by the Brits immediately after it became clear that this had not gone according to plan, meant that they were then incapable of extracting themselves and saying, look, you know, why the hell did you get us into this mess? The other thing you have to remember is that in wartime, there's not much to be gained from actually having a public row about something that's gone wrong. Everything is really weighted in presenting a sort of united front and saying, and carrying on with this this fairy tale that's concocted, that, oh, this was all actually intended in some weird way, and that we were expecting heavy losses, but the price was worth paying because of the lessons we learned, which down the line, D-Day saved numerous lives and made the whole operation a success. You know, we may come on to that, but, you know, I completely do not buy that argument. It was concocted. Actually, in advance of the raid, the kind of PR strategy was, if it's all a huge cock-up, then we're going to say that it was all in order to learn lessons. So they had had their sort of defense in place even before it went wrong.
So here's a phrase you probably never thought you'd hear. Battery-powered locomotive. And I'm not talking about model trains. Yep, a 200-ton steel behemoth capable of several thousand horsepower, hauling an entire train, but running on batteries. A lot of batteries. Our sponsor, CN, just commissioned one. It's going to look like a regular locomotive, and it'll be just as powerful, but without direct greenhouse gas emissions, air contaminants, and engine noise. When the first specimen arrives, it'll be used to move rail cars around the train yard, switching them between tracks, that sort of thing. Eventually, the plan is to pair it with regular locomotives. You've probably seen trains being pulled by two locomotives. The idea is that the battery-powered locomotive would be used to help power a train up a hill. Just an example. These new locomotives will not be hybrids. They will be entirely electric-powered. And yes, they'll be plugged in for charging, sort of. They'll likely have a power transfer platform on the roof, which will be used to connect the locomotive to the grid. Like e-cars, they'll charge in a few hours. But where a Tesla, say, attaches to a 150-kilowatt supercharger, the new CN locomotives will slurp from a 1,000-kilowatt connection. We're talking a lot of juice. Will they be the future? CN doesn't know yet, and neither does anyone else. But the railway does know it's committed to reducing greenhouse gas emission intensity by over 40% within the next 9 years. Catenary power, powering the locomotive by electrified tracks or a separate line, is also under consideration. So is hydrogen. So is a combination of battery, catenary, and hydrogen. In any case, one way or the other, CN intends to eventually stop burning fossil fuel in its fleet. The electric delivery trucks the railway ordered last year are further proof. One CN train already does the work of hundreds of tractor trailers with a lot less emissions, and the railway will get much greener. That's a promise. So the plan itself. The plan itself, I'm going to simplify it for my listeners, Mr. Bishop. The plan itself is, okay, we're going to attack this inlet, this town that has a very small beach surrounded by cliffs. And on top of these cliffs are German guns, and embedded in these cliffs are German guns. And the beach itself is not sand, it's rock. You can't run across it. You can't move across it very well. We're going to land our people and our tanks on this. And they're going to be supported by air bombardment, which is going to take out some of the German guns, and sea bombardment from big, massive warships that are going to bombard the cliffs. And you guys are going to walk up, you and the tanks are going to walk up the beach and take Dieppe. So... according to your book, that makes no sense even as it is. That's not going to work, that plan, even as it is. And then the bomber, the person in charge of bombing in the Royal Air Force says, well, we're not diverting our bombers to do that. We're not doing that. So there's no bombing raid for the thing. And the Navy says, no, we're not prepared to commit, take the chance of losing a major warship in this shitty exercise. So we're only going to send over some small ships that cannot do any damage to the German guns in the cliff. And the project still goes ahead. So a project that people said, maybe this thing has a 5% chance of success if we get the air support and the sea support. Then you take away the air and the sea support, and the thing goes ahead anyway. So walk us through the culture of an organization in which changing circumstances have no impact on decision-making.
Yeah, well, this is, I think it's not so much the culture of the organization as the composition of the those involved, of the participants. So, you know, this is a combined operation. So you've got the Air Force, you've got the Navy, you've got the Army, and the Army then you've got the Combined Operations Headquarters, Mountbatten's organization on top of that. So you've got four major elements. Inside the, each of those elements, you've got sort of, you know, competing views as well. So basically, no one is really invested in the plan. No one actually owns the plan, as we would say nowadays. And I think this created an atmosphere in which people who had a kind of finger in the pie thought, doesn't look great, but who knows, it might actually work, in which case I would put my hand up and say, yeah, that was my idea. And if it goes wrong, I could say, actually, it was his idea. So it's the old thing that, victory has many fathers, but defeat is an orphan. That is exactly what happened. So I think at no point did anyone get together, did enough people get together who felt they had enough to lose to say, look, let's pull the plug on this thing. It's clearly not going to work. The one person who could have done that was John Hamilton Roberts, the divisional commander of the Canadians. But he's this kind of sad, indeed tragic figure, I think, in the whole story, because he clearly was, you know, kind of mediocre. He was just about, I suppose, worth being given a divisional command. But in a very
He choked. At the key moment, he choked, right?
Yeah. I mean, he was given opportunity after opportunity to say, look, you know, my boys aren't going in there without naval support or air support or both. And he just sort of kept, he either kept quiet or he accepted these arguments, which now seem ludicrous, like, oh, if we bomb, it'll wake up German defenders and then they'll be ready when we arrive. And the naval argument actually has a bit of...
Long after there was no chance of there being any element of surprise. No chance.
Yeah, but as it turned out, though, I think the surprise thing, in the orders, over and over again, it goes on about surprises, why it will be, it all hinges on surprise. But yeah, the chances of landing 6,000 men on a broad front just before, you know, the idea that you're going to achieve any kind of realistic surprise, whatever happened, without accidents, as in which in fact was the case, was just, again, another, you know, very fanciful aspect of the plan.
Did you see the TV dramatization of Chernobyl last year?
I haven't.
I thought of it when I was reading the book, because it seemed to me that in both places there were people who knew obvious truths and wouldn't say them. Wouldn't say them because the person they were talking to had a rank in which you don't say that to that person, or because you have ambition and you don't want to get on the wrong side of that person. And at critical junctures, people don't tell the truth.
I think that's right. I mean, military structures don't encourage truth telling. You just basically salute, keep your mouth shut, and then try and do what you can to minimize what you know is going to be a cock-up in your own little way. There's certain fatalism is an essential part of military operations, you're kind of expecting to die anyway, you know, or that you're not expecting, you don't want to, but that prospect obviously looms large in your thinking. So I think, as you say, that does encourage people to not to pipe up.
So all of this inexplicable recklessness and people just letting something go ahead, even though they thought it was unlikely to be successful because they didn't want to get in the way of it, would they have been that reckless about it had it been British kids that were going to go do that fight?
That's a good question, which, to be honest, I haven't really given much thought to until you just mentioned it. Now, I sense that it wasn't. I don't think they were that callous. I think, you know, you've got 1,000 commandos going ashore as well, and various other elements. Like Americans, you know, 50 American Rangers in there. So I don't think it was anyone wanted to was making a distinction about, oh, Canadian lives are expendable, and it's not going to be impact too much on the home front if there are major losses. I certainly haven't come across anything that suggests that in writing. However, you know, it may be that there was this kind of, at the back of people's minds, a kind of feeling, well, you know, it's not going to be, if it is a disaster, it's going to be less of a disaster because the home front morale is not going to be as damaged as heavily as if it was British troops. So yeah, there may well be something in there.
You know, you read a book like this and it's mostly about the generals and the politicians and the decisions that they make. And after the battle, Churchill described it as gallant. And, you know, you'll hear words like historic, heroic thrown around and all this kind of thing. And you think these kids had volunteered for the army, probably thought they would have a chance at heroism or to do something. They never saw a German, right? They died getting out of the landing craft. People getting out of the landing craft are crawling over their comrades who've died just as they stepped outside the landing craft. There's no heroic fight. There's no duel with a German. There's nothing. There's just a silent bullet as you get out of the landing craft. There's nothing heroic about it. It's grim.
Yeah, that's something that strikes one very forcibly when you're reading the post-operation reports. The people that did get back were all, virtually every single one of them was interrogated. So you do have a great wealth of contemporaneous accounts of what happened. And that's something that comes to, I try and sort of recreate the battle as closely as I can. So there's a lot of the second half of the book is very much about the experience of the fighting. And that is a salient feature of it, is that no one actually, hardly anyone, fired their gun in anger. It was all about just scrabbling around, trying to find a barest scrap of cover you could to get out of the way of this absolutely relentless, withering machine gun fire, mortar fire. And from even before you got to the shore, the rounds are clanging off the landing craft. When the bow door actually goes down, the guy in front of you certainly is going to collapse, and you step into the bullets that he's just been felled by. So it was an unbelievably horrible experience, particularly on Blue Beach, the one just at the east of Dieppe, where the Royal Canadian Regiment went ashore, followed by the Black Watch, where the bodies were just stacked up. There was a sea wall there. It's a very narrow beach. There's a sea wall that's about 12, 15 feet high. And that was completely covered from every angle by German machine guns. When I went to Dieppe, I went, you know, many times to visit. And you stand on that little beach there, and you don't need much imagination to get some slight kind of, you know, feeling of what it must have been like. And the pictures that the Germans took afterwards really bring home the slaughter. There was no other word for it, that they were able to dole out without any real fear of anything coming back to hit them.
Since Confederation, owning a home has been part of the Canadian dream. For most people, that dream is much more than just a monthly mortgage payment. A home is where we create our fondest memories and where we can truly be ourselves. For too many, especially young adults, that reality is out of reach and it's getting worse. The good news is our original sponsor, the Ontario Real Estate Association, or REIA for short, has a plan to save the Canadian dream of home ownership. It includes lowering costs for first-time buyers, ending money laundering in the real estate market, and cutting years of red tape that is standing in the way of more affordable homes for families. The REIA plan will lay the foundation for a future where all people can find a place to call home. When we support the dreams of all of us who want to own a home, we're building healthier families, stronger communities, and a safer, more secure future for all. Read their plan at REIA.com/affordable homes. Well, thank you for sharing all this expertise getting to the bottom of some of the mysteries about this event. Any big lesson from it? Did you learn something from every one of these things that you write?
Yeah, I do. I mean, someone said to me, what's it like writing about something that doesn't seem to have any kind of redeeming features in it? It was an unmitigated disaster. Yeah, that's true. But I mean, the thing that I always take away and took away particularly profoundly from this book was just how decent, you know, soldiers can be to each other in dire circumstances. There is a kind of form of love, I think, that binds soldiers together, and these incredible stories of selflessness where people risking their lives over and over again to leave what little cover they've found and drag a comrade back into shelter where there may be a little bit of medical help available. It's incredibly moving. You know, you often had tears in my eyes when I was reading some of this stuff. So, yeah, I think there's if there is a kind of, you know, moral, uplifting moral to the story, it's just that war is a terrible, terrible thing, but you do get these kind of points of light in it where people behave with incredible heroism and selflessness and humanity that lighten the picture.
Where the humanity shines through an inherently inhumane thing.
Exactly.
Right. Patrick Bishop, great book. Operation Jubilee, terrible name for such an awful story. Operation Jubilee, Dieppe, 1942, The Folly, The Sacrifice. I highly recommend it to all of my listeners. I want to thank our presenting sponsor, TELUS, and our sponsors, CN Rail and the Ontario Real Estate Association, for helping bring this to it. I want to thank you, Patrick Bishop, for in London having taken the time to talk to us about this and share your thoughts. And thank you, all your hurly-burlyites, for listening or watching, and we'll be back next week. And in the meantime, do your homework. Read the book. Hurly-burly.